The next question has got to logically be, so how do you do this? And maybe more particular, what tools or tactics does your organization use to establish and maintain these networks? So, Mary, why don't you give us an example of a tool that you use at WinRock to keep your network active and managed well?
Sure. What I'd like to talk about is creating this animated video that we did to share, to engage a larger network in our new approach to water services that we were working on. Let me give you the context, because it's kind of a funny context behind it. In 2010, the Rockefeller Foundation decided to explore MUS as a new potential investment area. And in about mid-2011, I was having a debrief with our program officer right after a board meeting. And Christina said to me that Sandra Day O'Connor, and I don't know how many of you know her, she is a retired Supreme Court Justice, a U.S. Supreme Court Justice, and the first woman on the Supreme Court. And she said, MOOC sounds too technical. And we were pretty stunned, and we thought, well, in order for this idea to really take off and for us to engage a larger audience and get broad-scale buy-in for MUS, if Sandra Day O'Connor, this brilliant Supreme Court justice, couldn't understand what it's about, and it's a really simple idea, we had a big problem on our hands. So we decided to step out of our NGO sort of development comfort zone and work to create a short animated video to explain what MUS was in simple and compelling ways. For any of you who are interested, maybe after the call, you can look on YouTube. It's called Keeping the Water Flowing, and it's a two-minute animated video that will give you a sense of our work. The challenge was to explain what we were doing in a simple and compelling way to increase interest and engagement. And the reason that we use the video, which I think that the animated video is worth mentioning, is that we decided to go with animation rather than pictures because we wanted to do two things. First of all, when people see animation, they naturally tend to relax and they're more receptive. We've all got kind of our blinders on or our lenses that we look at things through. And by using animation, it allows us to relax. The second thing is it allows people to see the ideas that are presented in the video, and then they can attach them to their own context. And we know they're coming from a variety of contexts. So the animation was an interesting tool, I think, that we used. The video has been incredibly successful for engaging people. It's just been a fabulous tool. And each time I start it, particularly for a group, I chuckle inside and I say, Sandra Day O'Connor, this video goes out to you. I don't know if she's actually ever seen it, which you should ask Kippy about. But that's one tool we've used. Two other related tools, for that's sort of the entry-level tool for engagement. The second one is we developed a very visually appealing guide to MUS, working with IDEO.org, the human-centered design firm in San Francisco. And then for folks that want to dig a little bit deeper, we've now developed this training course as well, and we're working on other types of tools. So my encouragement to people who are listening is think about different ways, different things, methods, and tools that you could use to engage people and networks.
Perfect. And I like the idea of almost starting off with a communications tool, which is not something that people always think about for networks. Mark, let's move over to you and how you guys are using tools or tactics to engage and manage your network.
Thank you. I'm also just going to kind of wrap in a little answer to somebody was talking about reaching out to different networks. One of the things, and this is referencing back to what Eric said, is that they are messy, and I think that it's important that we look at them as happening at all different kinds of levels. Some of them will be very engaged. Some of them will be less engaged. Some of them might be temporary connections having to do with a specific situation or event, and others might be longer term and become more formal. And I think all of those are very relevant, and it's not important to really clearly define one. And one of the tools that we used in a situation we had a few years ago in one of our regions where traditional journalism was going by the wayside because of new information technologies, and there was a large number of really experienced journalists that had been contributing significantly to their communities, but because a lot of them were from the traditional media sector, it was very possible that those media outlets they were working for were actually going to shut down. And the networks that they had established pre-established were not necessarily the networks that were going to help them address this problem, as many of those people had similar issues. And so we implemented a social innovation camp. And the idea there was to get our more traditional journalists connected with a very different set of people, with technologists, with people who were working in communities and doing, whether it be citizen journalist networks or other approaches, and to really get them thinking very differently about how they could use some of these new tools in getting information out to their communities and kind of reaching across, you know, different sectors. And what was most interesting about this kind of cross-fertilization was that it was not just the new information technology types that were very interested in actually learning something, or that there was a connection to traditional journalists, that in some cases they kind of looked at them as dinosaurs, but once they actually sat down in a room and started working on some innovative projects with them, they realized that there was a lot of crossover. But with some of the technologists, it was very interesting to see how they started to see the importance of just media in general, or how to use media, whether it be the new IT or whether it be some of the more traditional. And I think that one of the things that worked best about this gathering was that it was not a one-off meeting. It was not just an encounter and then everyone went their separate ways. Because we had various pilots that were developed, group projects, if you will, or that were developed in this week together, those spun off, and people that were together in a room but then separated across, you know, regions continued to work on these together. But then there were others, like I was saying earlier, that were less frequent but continued to influence the way they thought about things, the way they approached their work, the ongoing relationships that they would then start to develop with other people in their own region. So it was a way of actually opening them up so that they actually started looking more at networks themselves. So it was an important tool for us, and what we're doing now is that we're realizing that that social innovation camp has to be very different wherever we use it, or just an innovation camp is a tool, whether it's in northern Pakistan or whether it's in Kenya. It is a tool that has to be adapted each time to the audience. I mean, this is one of the important things, I think, with a lot of different tools is the flexibility that we need to see with them.
Excellent example and a good pointer for everybody to make sure that they are thinking about the customization towards either geographic or cultural nuances that certainly will be required for many of the participants listening. So Eric, let's hear about tools and tactics you use at Ushahidi.
You know, at Ushahidi, we came from a kind of a non-traditional background, and our team has never been in the same country. In fact, we're across seven different time zones. The founders didn't actually meet in person as a group until a year and a half into the organization's existence. So it's always been a little bit different for us. And by that, I mean that we've had to come up with different tools to communicate, number one, but also made us form our organization in a way that has a lot of trust built into it, because you can't wait 7 hours for somebody to wake up when a decision has to be made around some type of crisis or disaster. So, you know, a couple things that we do is that when people join the team, you'll often find them in their first month out there speaking to someone out there in the world at an event about Ushahidi. This, number one, shows that we trust. Number two, gets them out there facing individuals who might be using the software and having to explain it. And it helps us show that we trust them, number one. Number two, helps them show that they know what they're talking about. And though they might say it a different way than me or Juliana or David, they understand the ethos and can get the point across. It also means that they're much more confident about making decisions on their own in a timely manner when there might not be anybody awake to help them with the problem. The second thing we've done is, because we're so distributed, we also build different types of vehicles that allow for interaction with other organizations and other individuals. For example, at Ushahidi, Patrick helped us build the Crisis Mappers network out. The Crisis Mappers was just a loose connection of people. Really, it allowed for the serendipity of online serendipity of people just kind of meeting up and finding out about each other. And then when something happened, they formed together. And then out of this comes the Standby Task Force, which helps with crises and disasters around the world. And from the same group of people came the International Conference on Crisis Mapping, which, you know, if you think about those three different networks that have been created, we're now dealing with both small and large organizations, people who are both intimidated and excited about what we do. So that's very exciting to me as somebody who has to kind of lead the organization and think about strategy for everything. It means that we have our links into these people before they're needed. A second example of this is we built the iHub in Nairobi, and that too, it's not about ownership for us. It's about us creating a platform that a bunch of people can come into. New and exciting ideas abound, and we're just one of those groups. We're one of those or members in that whole network. And that allows ideas to permeate, ideas to shift, ideas to pass from one person to another. And you never know who's going to create the next thing. And so we've hired out of the iHub, but we've also run hackathons and different types of events that people have taken our ideas and spun them out into new things that we wouldn't have thought of. And we've received other people's ideas and internalized them for new features within the software itself.
What's great about these three answers for me is that they stretch a continuum of engaging a network. So the first one, how do you actually do communications from Mary's example? The second one of how do you really create network engagements from Mark? And then Eric really talking about the organizational structure and culture necessary for networks to be engaged effectively. I think for all of us listening in here, if we just took those three elements alone, how do we communicate what we're doing and communicate to a network? How do we think about creating engagements? We're actually bringing that network together to solve real problems. And then what is it that we need to do at our own organizations to build our culture and our acceptance and our own capacity to engage them? We'll probably go a long ways.